This is the second day of this July 2009 seven-day session. We'll resume reading from our text of yesterday, a book called Zen Essence, translated and edited by Thomas Cleary. It's a collection of miscellaneous little bits of teaching by a variety of ancient Chinese masters from the Tang and Sung dynasty. Let's finish up with yesterday's Ma Zu from the 8th century. He said, "Human delusions of time immemorial, deceit, pride, deviousness, and conceit have conglomerated into one body. That is why the sutras say that this body is just made of elements, and its appearance and disappearance is just that of elements, which have no identity. When successive thoughts do not await one another, and each thought dies peacefully away, this is called absorption in the oceanic reflection." So our habit forces, since time immemorial, back thousands, millions of lifetimes in the past, these tendencies or dispositions that we have reinforced in our actions and reactions, our words and our thoughts, these have a kind of density that becomes a body. We're born into a body, and the physical body is a reflection of our karma, our unresolved stuff. He mentions these things: deceit, pride, deviousness, conceit. Basically, it comes down to the three poisons: greed, anger, and delusion. We are born again and again and again because we still have some of these impurities that we need to purify. This is not so bizarre a teaching when we consider that even modern physics confirms that what appears so substantial, our bodies and everything else that's physical, is actually energy. Energy that has assumed a certain pattern, a form. And this is also what's promising about the future, is that through practice, by working with our mind energy, as well as the body, but working with these energies, these psychophysical, spiritual energies, we change ourselves. We reform ourselves. But fundamentally, what appears so substantial is empty, is without any enduring, fixed substance. It gives the appearance of having substance. This is what is so difficult to accept about such a teaching, is how can this world of things and bodies and trees and so forth be empty? Well, because our senses deceive us. Our human senses have a great range of ability, but when you get out to the extremes of subatomic particles and also astronomical vastness, we can't see things as they really are. So we believe in these appearances. We believe that things are not empty, that they have some fixed mass to them, when in fact they don't. And our modern instruments confirm that this really is space. Space in different forms, different colors, but space. So he says, so the sutras say that this body is just made of elements, and its appearance and disappearance is just that of elements. The elements are, one way of describing these elements are the five skandhas. This is what we chant at the beginning of the Prajnaparamita. The bodhisattva of compassion from the depths of Prajna wisdom saw the emptiness of all five skandhas. Skandhas, many of you know, skandhas is one of these rich Sanskrit words that means aggregates or heaps. And they refer to the components or the constituents of what we call the I, of the elements of selfhood. And these five are form, it's our physical form, feeling or sensation. We have feelings, we have sensations, we sense things, we hear, see, smell, taste, touch, and think things. The third is perception or thought. We can't get into the complexities of these skandhas. It would take us too far afield. They have different, they're translated differently by different, in different sources, but that's the third. The fourth is a bundle of different words like choice, intention, volition. These are the habit forces per se. And then the fifth is consciousness itself. So we come into being, into existence, when these five come together. And without any of these five, there is no self as we know, no personhood as we know it. But the point is that that these five are all impermanent. We are in flux. There is a relative continuity to them. There's a continuity of usually 70, 80, 90 years. And then these things break up, they disappear, and we disappear, what we call the I disappears, until they come back together in rebirth as another light and another body-mind. And then with this, where he says, when successive thoughts do not await one another, and each thought dies peacefully away, this is called absorption in the oceanic reflection. Well, we know, of course, about these succession of thoughts, these trains of thoughts that we get on, that we board in our sitting, where one thought leads to another, to another, to another, to another. The Japanese word for this is nen. And it's not exactly thought. Maybe the closest definition of nen is thought moment. Nen is the is translate. We translate in the Kanongyo. We translate Nen as moment, but it could also be translated as thought. In the end, there, those last two lines, this moment arises from mind. This moment itself is mind. For years, we said this thought arises from mind. This thought itself is mind. But neither one is perfect as a translation. But it means this continuity of the mind's output. The Chinese master Linji or Rinzai said, just cut off successive nen, and this is worth more than 10 years of pilgrimage. Learn to cut off successive thoughts. That is, detach from the momentum of thought energy. This is what we're doing. This is Zazen, learning to cut off successive nen. Before the cutting off comes the noticing. That's step number one, noticing when the mind is off and running. And then once we notice, then to return our attention to the practice, or depending on the practice, or just let go of the thought form that is taking us away. And each thought dies peacefully away. So they arise, thoughts arise all the time in the mind. If we don't involve ourselves with these thoughts, then they just expire. They just run their course. They're not a problem. And then our thought is really no thought. Our thoughts are not obstructions, they're not obstacles, they don't impinge on the mind. They're just sort of doing what thoughts do and don't need to be a problem. The problem comes in our clinging to the thoughts, our grasping at them, our pursuing the thoughts. In other words, our engaging with them in any way. That's where they become obstacles. Turning to the next chapter, now this is, in fact, the same Zen master Linji, who was in the next generation after Mazu. He died in 866. He said, people who study Buddhism should seek real, true perception and understanding for now. If you attain real, true perception and understanding, birth and death don't affect you. You are free to go or stay. You needn't seek wonders, for wonders come of themselves. Well, of course he's talking about coming to genuine, thoroughgoing realization. I think one of the troubling aspects of the westernization of Zen is that this fundamental experience of enlightenment is getting marginalized. It's getting ignored more and more. But it's really our fundamental potential as human beings to awaken to this self nature, awaken to the nature of reality. And having done so to a small degree, then to go on and deepen that realization. And then we come to understand death differently, and with it, life. There was a Japanese master, Bunan, who said, "Die while alive and be completely dead, then do whatever you will, all is good." We also have this great collective denial of our deaths. Anyone who thinks they don't sustain a kind of an overarching denial of death should see their response if they were to suddenly be diagnosed with a terminal illness, the shock to the system. In ancient times, it seems death was so much more visible and common. And when people lived in tribal arrangements, the whole range of the elderly, and that the elderly, the very old, were not put away out of sight. The dying were not put away in hospitals. It was an ever-present fact that one would have a harder time denying. No doubt there was still denial. The masters are constantly reminding their students of this, the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death. I think that's the responsibility of any teacher, to not let anyone completely cover that over. This statement, after realization, he said, you don't need to seek wonders, for wonders come of themselves. I wonder whether a different translator would use this word wonders, but let's go with this. You don't need to seek wonders. Well, this could be seeking enlightenment, because awakening just happens. It could mean you needn't seek anything special, because everything becomes special after awakening. After an awakening experience, someone said, "I knew that I would never again be bored." everything becomes more or less marvelous, full of wonder, wonderful. Everything becomes mysterious, amazing, when we see it as it is, and not through the prism of our notions, our conditioning. They're all around us. The way sunlight or a shadow plays across the floor. The way the breeze feels against our cheek. The most ordinary things, when the mind is empty, not clogged with thoughts, when the mind is empty, everything, anything can assume this marvelous quality, this wondrous quality. He goes on, "What I point out to you is only that you shouldn't allow yourselves to be confused by others. Act when you need to, without hesitation or doubt. People today can't do this. What is their affliction? Their affliction is their lack of faith in themselves." Another translator put it this way. They have Lin Chi saying, "What ails you? Lack of faith in yourself is what ails you." He goes on, "If you do not spontaneously trust yourself sufficiently, you will be in a frantic state, pursuing all sorts of objects and being changed by those objects, unable to be independent." Well, of course, he's describing the average person. Most of us, in fact, pursuing all sorts of objects, goals, ideals, notions, not to mention physical things. Most of this arises from this sense of insufficiency, this unawareness of our own completeness. And of course, we're changed by objects that we become attached to. How could we not be changed when we attach to them? Our possessions come to possess us. How everybody here knows this. He goes on, "There is no stability in the world. It is like a house on fire." Let's just take that sentence. We could rephrase it, "There is no ultimate security for any of us." How could there be when we are all under this law of impermanence? How could there be any ultimate security when everything is in flux, when there is this certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death. It is like a house on fire. That's a metaphor that the Buddha himself used in his fire, what's called a fire sermon. This is not a place where you can stay for a long time. The murderous demon of impermanence is instantaneous, and it does not choose between the upper and lower classes or between the old and the young. We all know this. Of course we know this, but do we really know it? If we really knew it, if we had really assimilated these facts, these truths, we'd probably lead our lives quite differently than we do. And then he again says, if you want to be no different from the Buddhas and Zen masters, just don't seek externally. Another one. Because you grasp labels and slogans, you are hindered by those labels and slogans, both those used in ordinary life and those considered sacred. Thus they obstruct your perception of objective truth, and you cannot understand clearly. It's quite sobering and really a never-ending process of realizing how much we are conditioned by thoughts and concepts. You could say that this is, in one sense, this is what working on koans comes down to, is coming to see how much our minds are conditioned by words and concepts. And we're sucking in words and concepts all the time through our exposure to most of what we are hearing and seeing all day long in our lives. We're saturated with media messages, most of them the most worthless kinds of messages. And these things work their way into our minds. There's no question about this. We may think that we can see through all of the stuff that we're exposed to, but it still works its way into the mind. It's very sobering to consider what we may confront after death. And we're in this intermediate realm of called the bardo, where any number of millions of sense impressions from the past that have been planted like seeds in the mind can sprout, can emerge when we're in a vulnerable state. Well, we can get some sense of this from Sesshin, especially later in Sesshin, when the mind becomes very still and quiet. This is a real kind of little snapshot of the bardo. And some of the things that float into the mind when we're in that state can be very sobering. And how long these things may have lain in the mind, just as seeds, millions, millions, and millions, and millions of sense impressions. As we scan a room or a horizon, all of that is being filed away in the mind. Same with sounds, feelings, touch, smells. It's all finding its way to what the texts call the storehouse consciousness, the alaya vijnana. And it's just a matter of the suitable causes and conditions as they arise that trigger these things that come up into the mind. And that condition our actions and our reactions to people and to situations. These labels and slogans, he says they're both those used in ordinary life and those considered sacred. So our own vocabulary we can become attached to. Our own Zen or Buddhist vocabulary. It's one of the really exceptional things about the Zen tradition is recognizing that even our most cherished terms like Buddha, enlightenment, these things can become obstacles if we get stuck to them. If you want to be free, get to know your true self. It has no form, no appearance, no root, no basis, no abode, but is lively and buoyant. It responds with versatile facility, but its function cannot be located. Therefore, when you look for it, you become further from it. When you seek it, you turn away from it all the more. So then what is it? What is this true self? What is Mu? What could it be? No appearance, no form, no root, no basis. And yet, it's lively, buoyant, bright, responsive. What is it? He says, just put thoughts to rest and don't seek outwardly anymore. When things come up, then give them your attention. Just trust what is functional in you at present, and you have nothing to be concerned about. Again, I think he's saying, basically, just respond to things as necessary. You get a notice in the mail that your driver's license is going to expire. Okay, you do. You respond to that. You pay attention to it. You hear of someone having a baby. you respond to that. Get hungry, you respond. When things come up, then give them your attention. Just trust what is functional in you at present. This and this. Responding to conditions and circumstances as they arise without living in the future or the past, dwelling in those thoughts. Don't seek outwardly anymore. There are blind baldies who, after they have eaten their fill, do zazen and practice meditation, arresting thoughts leaking out to prevent them from arising, shunning clamor and seeking quiet. This is a deviated form of Zen. Well, here he's commenting on what were probably lots of monks who entered the monastery at the time, and for all kinds of convenient reasons, and misused their zazen, their sitting, as a way to just to try to escape from things and withdraw into what they thought as this private, quiet, little, cozy space where they don't have to worry about anything or respond to anything. We have the capacity to misuse anything, even something as extraordinarily precious as meditation. There was a great Chinese master by the name of Yong Chia who said, "Those who cling to vacancy, neglecting the world of things, escape drowning but leap into the fire." It's a warning to those who want to use their meditation for escapist reasons, to escape from the world, escape from people, escape from conflict, escape from problems, but real, true meditation practice is engaging with the world, with people, serving people, doing what needs to be done, not trying to flee phenomena. There's nothing wrong with phenomena. Nothing to fear of phenomena, people, things, work, change. The whole point of the practice is to harmonize with these things, to become one with what needs to be done. Where would we be if these masters had just secluded themselves away from everyone and never given back to others what they had received themselves? Here's one last one where he's talking about supernormal faculties. This is a term from his day there's a pronounced streak of the interest in the supernatural and superstition in Chinese Buddhism, more so I think than in Japanese Buddhism, and I think certainly more so than Western Buddhism so far. And this could be another diversion, another wrong direction. And so he says here, the six supernormal faculties of the enlightened are the ability to enter the realm of form without being confused by form, to enter the realm of sound without being confused by sound, to enter the realm of scent without being confused by scent, to enter the realm of flavor without being confused by flavor, to enter the realm of feeling without being confused by feeling, and to enter the realm of phenomena without being confused by phenomena. Confused means, one way to understand that is attached to. So when hearing sounds, music, not being attached to them. The same with sights, tastes. Smells, fragrances. It's really talking about detachment, which is ultimately the key thing to move through our lives without getting bound by things, to be fully open and in touch with all of our senses and responsive without getting caught in these six sense realms. Well, this is just a natural byproduct of sitting. The longer we practice, the more willy-nilly, just little by little, we come to discover that we are becoming more detached, which really means more free. We're becoming freed up of things that used to bind us. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.